listening to Syntax, the podcast with the tastiest web development treats out there. Strap yourself in and get ready. Here is Scott Tolinsky and Wes Boss.
Welcome to Syntax. This is a podcast with the tastiest web development treats out there. Today, we've got a potluck for you. Some really good questions, some stuff that I'm really excited about in Node modules, custom loaders in ES modules in Node, which is going to be really cool. Talking about salaries, Git LFS, a bunch of really neat stuff. So stay tuned for some tasty treats. Today we're sponsored by two awesome companies. First one is Sentry, that does all of your error and exception tracking. And the second one is Stackbit, which is the best way to Jamstack. We'll talk about both of them partway through the episode. How are you doing today, Scott?
Hey, too good. Doing as good as I could be doing. Just grinding out, working on my stuff as always. And I don't know. Doing all right, I guess. It's scatterbrained nonetheless.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, getting a little sick of the lockdown.
It's difficult to make it all work. I know, we both have those experiences, but man, I've been doing a lot of work to refine sort of how I think about being productive and what needs to fall into place, the systems I have in place for making myself productive. And having an off day in those regards really hurts a lot more. It hurts a lot more now.
Yeah. You only have so much time and you have a bad day. Like the other day I had something went wrong and my whole plans for the day went out the window and I had to spend time fixing something. And it's just a bummer to waste that time.
Especially right now there's just so many things to do 24/7, So yeah, when you have one off one or a couple off ones, it really, really hurts. So yeah, ready to get into this potluck.
First question we got here is from Mark Haslam. What are subscriptions in React or programming in general? The React docs mentioned that setting up a subscription in an example is a side effect, but what exactly is a subscription and when do you set one up? So this idea here is not a React specific thing and it's more of just a programming thing. So in React, we know that sometimes we have to go off and listen for events or get some data from a database, or in this case, it's talking about a subscription, which is generally what's going to happen is you're going to add an event listener to something, some sort of data being streamed in, or most likely you're going to have a database that is sending live data in over a WebSocket. So because that is going outside of the React component and setting up event listeners, that is what is referred to as a side effect in a React component, because it doesn't just take in data and return some JSX and whatnot. It actually goes outside of it and makes a connection with the database or makes a connection with something else on the website. So that is what they mean by a subscription. And how do you set one up? It depends on what it is. It might be as simple as doing an add event listener on the window resize method. That would be a subscription to that event. Or it might be setting up a WebSocket connection event where you're listening for specific messages and then piping them into state. So it's one of those words where you see it and you go, is that actually a thing or is that just a general programming idea? And it's the second of those.
Right. Yeah. And there's oftentimes too the whole idea of you might hear it referred to as pub sub. And there's the idea of publishing and subscribing to information, whether or not it is being passed over a WebSocket, whatever, where anytime information gets updated, that publish happens of whatever the data. And since you're subscribed to it, the new data will come in. What's funny is that the entirety of Meteor, my platform that I work on, not one that I've created, obviously, but Meteor is all PubSub basically out of the box. It doesn't have to be, but it makes it super easy. So I've been working in subscriptions with React and otherwise for a long time, I think. And it made some things very easy when everything's a subscription, it made other things very difficult. So sometimes I think that obviously subscriptions aren't for everything, right? You can subscribe to specific types of data and it can work really well. Other times it's just going to get in the way. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I just Googled PubSub on Google Images just to get a, one of those visuals as to what it is as we were talking about it. And it suggests Publix. So it's like Publix is like the grocery store in like in Florida.
I don't think we have those.
So I clicked on it and there's like these amazing subs that you can get at Publix. So I want that kind of pub sub.
Yeah. Or like, what about like, it would be like a really good bar. Like a, you go to the pub and get a sub at the bar too.
Get a sub. Yeah. Like a nice pub sub. Yeah, that's true. Like, oh man, Ricky's Pub has the best subs.
Is that a real thing? I couldn't tell if you made up Ricky's Pub.
Oh, no. No, Ricky's is not a real thing.
Oh, that sounds like a
pub
sure
to me. Yeah. I'm sure.
Okay, next question here is from Jack. The question is, using the latest Node ESM imports, is it possible to use aliases? Using the old require syntax, I use the npm package module alias, but I cannot seem to find a solution for Node v14 imports. In a deeply nested file, I find that the import ... really awful compared to at some folder with an alias. And actually, Jack, I'm going to say I absolutely agree with you. I really, really cannot stand relative imports in that sort of sense. In fact, I will go to great lengths to avoid that kind of thing just because, again, that is so hard for me to parse, to see that ... like, and to try to have some sort of understanding of what nested structure I'm actually in. So I'm right there with you. Wes, you actually have a solution for this here that you found. I have not used this myself, considering I just do everything through Babel. So,
yeah, so I've played with the ES modules in Node quite a bit because I'm really excited for them to be added. There's a couple like things that aren't there yet. And when I was looking into if they're coming, they mentioned these things called loaders. And I dug a little bit more into loaders. And it turns out that Node is implementing the ability to add custom loaders, similar to like a Webpack plugin or a Babel plugin that would handle specific files or specific loading requires in a certain way. Or I even think it's kind of like a service worker where it jumps in before the actual module is loaded and you can write some custom logic in there. So I was just looking into that. I'm like, oh yeah, I know they're working on loaders for Node. I wonder if you can write your own. And it turns out you can write your own. And they have an example on the Node docs. I'll put a link in the show notes for a transpiler loader so that if you wanted to require TypeScript or CoffeeScript or SAS files, if you wanted to import them into your Node, you could write a loader that sits in between, intercepts those requests, and then returns the actual formatted and parsed JavaScript. So in your case, I'm betting, I don't know if this is true or not, but I'm betting what you can do is you can write a loader and then intercept all of those and say, if it starts with like a, what is it? The at that the alias module uses, if it uses that, then replace that with the relative path, which sometimes is ... So kind of cool. I probably wouldn't use that just yet. I would probably just run your code through Babel and then use a Babel plugin for that. That's probably what I'd recommend if you're using ES modules in general right now, because they're not ready in Node just yet.
Yeah, I think that sometimes a key thing is that if something's feeling like maybe the tooling isn't the same place or isn't there quite yet, man, you don't have to start using it. Especially, I mean, not even just the tooling, but in this case, the actual thing. And I mean, I see this with like Dino. I'm so used to saying Dino, where people will be like, I want to use Dino. And then they go to the Reddit and they'll be like, what's the express of Dino? Well, I mean, it's people are still working on stuff. You know, the landscape and everything is going to change. It's going to grow. It's going to evolve. So with anything new, I'm sure there'll be a solution here.
Absolutely. Next question we have here is from Laura. I've been a full-time developer for 10 years and my company has a fairly flat hierarchy. I want to take on more responsibility and salary, but my company doesn't have anything like a lead developer position. Any ideas on how to move up without switching companies? I know my boss would be receptive if I came to him with a pitch, but we work full stack, so it feels like I'm already doing it all. So this is cool. Like, sounds like you're pretty happy in your happy in your job. You just want to move up a little bit more and thus make more money without having to switch jobs, which I think is really cool. So it sounds like your boss is pretty receptive to this type of thing. So if that was me, I would, at a certain point, I think you sort of reach the top with being a developer. And in order to maybe make more money, you have to take on more responsibility. And if this was me, I would talk to the boss about how does the business actually make money? And then that goes from just being a dev and building the things that need to be built and taking care of all of the code to how can we push this business a little bit forward? And I'm going to come to the table with technology as my special weapon. So I don't know what that looks like in your specific company, but taking on some sort of special project where maybe we can make this process more efficient, or maybe we can bring in more customers by building something that would do that, a customer machine or something like that.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I think you hit some really good points here, especially because I worked at a small agency before. And at some point, the only way to, you know, make more money or move up was to get more ownership in the company. So I think that's really definitely a place that you could look at if that's where you want to go, maybe even more responsibility, more ownership. But again, like Wes mentioned, technology is going to be your superpower here, even if it's something simple like understanding the internet requirements, and maybe you can save $100 a month on internet services, you know, just like little things like that. You have an expertise in this that other people just aren't going to have by the nature of your background and training. And maybe you can find some cheaper or maybe some more interesting or more productive solutions for the company. And, you know, companies value that kind of thing, and they most likely be not only willing to renegotiate a new job title, new kind of thing, but you're probably not going to make a ton more money as a developer, just building, you know, widgets and websites without moving into a different location. Like, I don't mean like physically moving into a different like physical skill set where you're using your skills to maybe a little bit more like a bigger picture stuff with this business. How is, like you said, how is this business making money? How can you assist in that? And what does that look like for you? To me, if you are looking to remain writing code, and I mean writing code full time, not writing code at all. Like if you want to write code full time, be a full time dev and make more money, probably opening your own agency or, you know, working for a bigger employer is your ticket to making more money. But in terms of getting more responsibility outside of that space, maybe you can use some of your code skills to request a higher rate. Next question here is from Rami. He says, in Wes's website episode, he mentioned using Gatsby parallels for images, not LFS. Wes, do you want to talk a little bit about your decision here?
Yeah. For those who didn't listen to that one, the problem was that I have, I don't know, maybe 400 images on my website, and each of those images needs to be resized and compressed and put into several different sizes, making it a couple thousand images. And that was initially very slow. So I use this thing called Gatsby Parallel Runner, which uses Google Cloud to resize and do all of that all in parallel. So it runs them all at the same time, and that made it much faster. So the question was, why not Git LFS? So Git LFS is large file system. It's an add-on to Git that will allow you to put lots of large images or videos or things like that in your Git repo without like making it too big. Like you can put images in a Git repo, and I actually have all the images from my website, but I don't keep all of the compressed and resized versions in the Git repo because that would make it way too big. So the question is, why not that? And the reason to that is that the output of Gatsby is done into a build directory, and your build output is not included in your Git repo. Just your source files are, along with instructions on how to build that specific thing. Because if you included your entire build directory in Git, every single time you built the website, you'd have like 1,000 change diffs that would both make your Git repo huge, but also it's unnecessary and it gets messy. So that's not what Git LFS is for. It's not for the output of the build. And I bet, like, if I ever got into a position where the images and videos on my website were too large for just a regular Git repo, that actually would be a good solution for holding the original images and the uncompressed versions of that.
Hmm. I have a small little aside.
Yeah.
Do you ever have Git commit issues? I mean, conflicts, not issues, but do you ever have conflicts with your package lock file? I seem to have them all the time, and I'm not quite sure if this is like a me problem. Am I updating things too much? I end up getting these, you know, where one person installs a package and then somebody else updates a package. And then when you do the merge, the yarn lock always complains. Then we have to dump the yarn lock. And it's like, why? What is this thing even doing for me if I'm dumping it all the time, you know?
Yeah, it's because the lock file contains the version of the package that you're using, not just the like 15 dependencies that you have for your project, but it has the like 20,000 dependencies that those dependencies have and those dependencies have and those, and it tells you every forever. Single one all the way down. And like those change so quickly that like if you run an NPM install, you're not technically changing anything about your code base, but because those things have changed since you've done it, that has come in. So I do run into those, not as frequently because I don't have as many people working on my code base. But I even run like Dependabot on GitHub always changes that. And then yours is out of date. And I too do that. Like I either just take whatever was coming in from GitHub or just nuke the entire thing and start again because it is frustrating.
Yeah, I almost always nuke the yarn lock file whenever it gets a conflict because I'm like, I don't want to parse through this and try to figure it out. It's just I wasn't sure if that was a pain point that was I was, you know, experiencing just me. That's really interesting about Gatsby. You know, it's funny because I don't do a ton of static, like big projects with images in static sites, you know? So it's definitely, there's so many, it's so funny. You hit these new approaches and they're always so easy at the small level, but at the, once you get into any sort of large level or more complex anything, there's always going to be pain points. It's just fascinating to me what your pain points are with the images and how you solve that sort of stuff. It's really cool. All right, next question here is from Nate Norberg. This is another question for Wes. It's any big green egg tips for here for beginners? I ordered a Kamado. Is that what it
Kamado,
is?
Kamado, yeah.
Kamado yep. style grill, and I'd appreciate any tasty tips you've got. I would too. We don't have a green egg or anything, but we gotta get some barbecue tips. About time.
Yeah. So a Kamado grill is just a ceramic grill that is shaped like an egg. And there's all kinds of benefits, the heat retention, and it's kind of like an oven and whatnot. I love mine. So I have two big green eggs. Kamado Joe is another really popular, really nice one. And then there's lots of like hardware store versions that are a little bit cheaper, but still pretty good. I love using mine. I have three of them. That's awesome. My tips are chicken thighs. That's like best and easiest thing to cook on there. They don't dry out. It's hard to overcook a chicken thigh and it just tastes so good. Chicken breast is so overrated.
Dude.
Chicken thigh is the best.
We moved to recently to like just about all chicken thigh instead of chicken breast for like everything. I'm like, and let me tell you, every meal that we make is better. Look, I make bibimbap with chicken, it's better. I make crispy chicken ramen, it's better.
Oh,
it's just
yeah.
so much better. Everything, it's so good.
True, and it's usually cheaper too, and it's so much better.
I don't understand. What is it, just because it's less meat? Is that why it's less desirable?
It's just
or
not
what?
As, like people think like, oh, it has fat in it. So it's like not as good for you, but it's super good for you. It's a good food.
It is a good food.
So chicken thighs, you can't goof it up. My favorite one is a little bit of sesame oil, a little bit of fish sauce, a little bit of salt, toss it in a bowl, grill that sucker over charcoal. Mwah! Chef's kiss. My other tips are, I just learned this one like a month ago and it blew my mind. So do you know what spatchcocking a chicken is?
I have heard the term. I think I've had it described at least once before, but it's not something that sticks in my brain.
Yeah. So if you like buy like an entire chicken, my favorite way to cook it is you cut the backbone out on either side of the backbone, you cut it out and you have the strip, you throw that in a pot, you make soup out of it later. and then you flip it over and then crack the breastbone, and then it lays flat when you cook it, and it cooks both faster as well as better. And then I just learned like a month ago that you can cut it horizontally. So like if vertically is where the backbone is, you can also cut it horizontally so that the thighs and drumsticks and all of that is separated from the breasts and the wings. And then you can cook the breast and all of that at a different rate than the lower half, like the dark and the white meat, because they cook differently. So you can pull them when they're ready. And I thought that was genius. I had never done that myself.
Yeah.
But that's just like another way to have it dialed in.
Yeah, that is very cool. I've seen Gordon Ramsay do that on Master Chef before, where they hit the hammer, they punch it, they punch the bird right in the spine. Yeah, I've seen that before. But no, I've never heard of this horizontal splitting technique. Wes, we need a cooking corner with Wes. That'd be I'm gonna need one of those.
That would be a good one. I got lots. I won't bore everybody here. I've got we'll do an entire cooking show at one point with little tips that we have. So we'll move on to the next one. But yeah, thanks for sending that one in.
Yeah. Well, moving on from cooking tips to bug finding tips and bug finding tips. I'm talking about our sponsor today, which is Sentry.io. And the sick tip I have for you with Sentry.io is to use it. Because, you know, there was a time when I had a Sentry and it was all set up and I just, I saw some issues coming in there. And I'll just say, you know, if I close Sentry, I just don't see the issues, right? But no, I use Sentry to my fullest capabilities nowadays. Like we talked briefly about this when we were first starting, but really needing to make the most of your time. And Sentry allows me to do that by finding an issue. Right. How many users is this affecting? How important is this issue? Is this a one-off kind of thing? Okay. Maybe is this caused by somebody's extension? If it's a problem, if it's something that we have to fix just based on seeing it, I can quickly and easily create a GitHub issue. I can tag Eric, who's working on Level Up tutorials, and he can take a look, or I can tag myself and I can get there and fix the problem. So for me, Sentry is the quintessential tool for things like this that I like. It keeps everything of one specific classification in one spot, i.e. every single error and exception that you have, keeps them all in one spot and allows you a really awesome interface for finding, fixing, and really keeping track of those bugs. So check it out at sentry.io. Use the coupon code TASTYTREAT, all lowercase, all one word, and you'll get 2 months for free. All right, next question here from Matt. Matt asks, inline code is considered harmful because of XSS attacks. That, for those of you at home, it's cross-site scripting attacks. Lighthouse recommends inlining critical CSS to improve page speed. What do you think of this trade-off? I don't necessarily know too much about this. I was doing some reading, and it's like some browsers could allow some JavaScript to be executed inside of a URL, inside of an inline CSS. I don't know. I mean, obviously, just simply having inline CSS on your website is not going to open you up for cross-site scripting attacks, because just about thousands and thousands of websites, more than that, would be exposed to that. Because for a long time, people used inline styles for all sorts of stuff just because of maybe ignorance in the past. But nowadays, inline styles are seen as something that can be added on where needed in a way that the browser can utilize those inline styles. So there's two sides of this. Sometimes people refer to inline CSS as CSS that's actually on the elements themselves. And other times, writing CSS inside of a style tag in an HTML document. So either of those could be considered inline code. I personally have not thought too much about cross-site scripting here. I've written CSS a long time, and I just kind of let the tools handle it for me. Right now, styled component sort of generates classes for me, but we do have that CSS, the critical server-side rendered CSS coming in from the server. About cross-site scripting attacks, Wes, do you know anything specifically about this? Because I've seen that it was possible, but the article that I was reading was like very old and it was talking about Opera. So I don't know anything about if this is an actual issue.
I feel like this is one of those, like I heard it once and I just believe it until I'm dead. Like, I have no idea. I might be wrong here, but I have no idea. Like, why would inline code be a potential XSS attack?
I don't understand that anytime that there is a URL in the CSS that some JavaScript could be executed there. But again, the only thing I saw in relation to that was about like an old like Opera version one. You know, I mean, it was back when, you know, IE day. So I don't really know if this is a current problem. I can't imagine it is, just because of how many things use inline CSS. I can't imagine it's an issue.
No, I don't think that this is an issue either. Like, no, there's nothing wrong with using either script tag and then JavaScript inside of that. Go to Facebook.com and view source. You'll see that they use that. Pretty much every website will have a script tag on it. And there's nothing wrong with using style tags in CSS to put it on. So I don't think that that is actually an issue. I'd probably, whenever you hear like a rule like that, push back and ask why. It's probably a very valid rule. You definitely need to ask, like, why is that an actual thing, and understand what the idea is behind it, because it might not apply to you, rather than you just like sort of blocking it entirely. Inlining CSS to improve page speed. Absolutely. Like, that's kind of a hard thing to do. And that's why we love Gatsby so much, because they do that for you. But absolutely, you should be doing that if your setup allows you to do it.
Yeah, totally.
Next question we have here is from Mark Hoslem. What advice would both of you have for being a first-time father, and how can I best prepare? My wife is pregnant, and we are both very excited. Congratulations. I want to do the best I can at being a good father. Our baby is due in January. Both of you are fathers multiple times. I would love your thoughts. Ooh.
Yeah,
that's a good question. I maybe should have prepped some of this. Why don't you go ahead and I'll think of some of my points.
my points are get a partner who is a child psychologist and just defer to them for everything, because that is what I do. I say something and then Courtney says, oh, you need to reread the book. And we're referring to like the How to Talk So Little Kids Will Listen book. She's like, you clearly don't remember the book. So I honestly defer a lot. And maybe it's just because like I think I had a good model. Like, my dad was, you know, he was really great. And I don't know. I'm running on instincts here. I have no real training here. I don't know what I'm doing. Just about never know what I'm doing. And for a long time, I was actually pretty uncomfortable as a father, if I, you know, can say that correctly. And for a long time, I was feeling kind of, you know, uncomfortable as a father, because when they're first born, they want mama for everything. And if you hold the baby cries, and, you know, you can run through the checklist of all the things that could be wrong. And the baby could still cry at the end of the day, just because you aren't mom. And so it was a little while before I was feeling competent and comfortable as a father, because again, it feels like for a little while, like no matter what you're doing isn't working. So, or at least that could be the case, right? So for me, it wasn't until Landon started being able to play more, and not like a little boy play, but like even just like very simple stuff, where like Brooklyn's just getting to that age right now, right? She's just over a year old. So we can do a little bit more involved games. She's showing me things. She's climbing the stairs. We're playing outside. We're doing those kind of things. She responds better to things like tickle or just those little things like that, that make it a little bit easier for me to really feel comfortable as a father, because you get to play more. Once it got into play territory, like, I can play all day. I can do that. That's fun. So that for me was a bit of a learning experience, and I felt pretty useless for a little bit. Just make yourself available early on in those early days.
Oh, that's good advice. I just jotted down a few things here that is important. I think like one of the best ways you can be a good father is supporting your partner. My wife and I learned early on. And my sister actually told us this, is nobody wins the who's more tired game.
you're both more tired. Yes.
When you're both up all night and you're miserable and the kids aren't sleeping and everything is awful, nobody's going to win the I'm more tired game. So that's try to support your partner and think about them as much as possible. take time for the kids. So like, I take a lot of time off in both in the summer as well as like a pretty easily will just ditch work and go hang out with my kids. As hard as that is for me, because I would just love to sit at my desk for a couple more hours and hack away on things. And there's always more projects. You can tell, like my daughter gave me a card the other day that says, "I love when we go fishing." And it was like, I was like, "Oh man, I'm so glad that I ditched work and went fishing with you the other day." And I was thinking I didn't want to, but I did, right? Like taking the time for the kid. And it's cliche, everyone says that, but like,
no, that's
like,
great.
Sort of like own that. And then also I think like try like one thing I'm thinking a lot about now is just like, how do you be a role model to your kids and how you treat other people? So just like, whether that's people in your family or just people on the street or people that you run into. And I'm starting to see that through my kids. They just talk to people at the stores all the time. And that's something I always do. Whenever we're at the grocery store, I always ask like, what's the most expensive bill you've ever seen? And then the people at the grocery store love hearing that. And like, I'm super curious, like what happened? Or like if some, you know, sometimes you're at the grocery store and there's somebody checking out with like 40 pineapples in a cart. You're like, what's going on there?
What are you doing? What are you doing with all those pineapples?
But like my kids are starting to like take that on and like just talk to cashiers and stuff like that. And I think that's probably the best way. Instead of just telling them treat people nicely, like you have to show them that that's how you do that.
Yeah, one thing I've really learned, I mean, you hear it, but you hear that kids soak up everything. But man, kids soak up everything. Landon says the funniest stuff with like, you don't even like know that he's paying attention, right? He's doing something else. And all of a sudden he'll be like, huh, I really need to go to my office to work on my work. What am I doing? I need to go on my work. And he's like saying the same stuff that you're saying or doing or whatever. Yeah. He's just like mimicking you in those sort of ways. And it'll just make you think, oh man, I gotta be 100% careful all the time about exactly what I'm modeling, because that modeling aspect is so key.
Oh, absolutely. One of our kids dropped a swear word the other day and I was like, what have I done?
I didn't. Yeah, that's funny. I cannot imagine. It's funny because in everyday life, I'm dropping them way more than Courtney. But Courtney definitely has a skill to drop them in front of the kids way more. Comparatively, it's like I'm pretty good at setting up that filter in front of the kids. And Courtney's are a little bit more emotive, where it's like, I cannot stop this from coming out.
Oh, man, that's so funny. All right. I just added that to the potluck title as fathership.
Yeah. Yes. Next question is from Talak Maddie. Are present web developers merely crud bastards for corporate culture? If not, what entrepreneurial opportunities are open with JavaScript and hooking up React with backend Node, Laravel, and reading Google Maps docs? Of course, the list isn't exhaustive, but you get my point, right? Note, I'm not interested in selling courses or creating frameworks. This is a weird question. It's basically saying, correct me if I'm wrong here, but it's basically saying like, what are the interesting career possibilities with this stuff, right?
I've got these skills. Right. Am I just going to be updating text boxes for the rest of my life? Or is there something a little bit more interesting? And also, no, I'm not going to create a course.
So they're looking for job advice or job information. Like, what are the types of jobs? But there seems, you know, the cool thing about this platform, the web specifically, is that the browser can do so many different things. So if you're really interested in doing different, more exciting things, there's a lot of opportunities out there. If you can think about it, just think about how many different things, right? So if you want to work on some more challenging problems or some more interesting problems, we have what? We have web graphics. We have 3D on the web. We have video for web. We have torrent for web. We have a ton of very difficult problems where you could do all sorts of cool stuff. Maybe you just like building animations and interfaces, or maybe you like creating portraits with CSS. So I would not describe it, any of the work, as being like just inherently just CRUD. I think CRUD makes up a very small percentage of my development time. A lot of my development time is building interesting interfaces and getting around really complex interaction problems and understanding how people are using things in a little bit more way than that's instead of writing just like database updates or that sort of stuff. But if you're on the server side of things, I don't know, maybe a little bit more difficult because that's not my specialty. But there's a lot of really interesting stuff going on that's not just CRUD in my mind.
Yeah, I agree. I think if you have that sort of base set of skills, then those are the type of jobs you're going to find. If you want to steer clear of that, and there's certainly nothing wrong with that. Like I build a lot of CRUD apps in my day to day, and there's always new and interesting stuff that comes up in building UIs around them and the data validation and all of that. But if that's the case, what you need to do is you need to like find whatever corner of the internet, like Scott was just saying, whether that's animation or video or building desktop apps or anything like that. And you need to find out what that thing is and dive deep into that and start writing blog posts and making YouTube videos. And because like the jobs that are doing that really, really niche and interesting things, the people that get those jobs are usually the people that are diving deep into them and they're sort of known for it. I don't think anyone's just going to hire you off the street and saying like, yeah, we need to start like 3D modeling this DNA samples. Do you think you could do that? I know that you're really good at like mapping state to props. I think like you probably can get some really cool jobs, but you need to start showing that you have those skills first.
Yeah, I think that's such a key thing is that you can get good at anything and probably get a job. I mean, if on the web right now, unless it's like, oh, I've mastered Netscape, you know, if you get really good at anything in 2020 on the web, there's going to be job opportunities out there. Somebody's going to need those crazy video manipulation skills you can do. Somebody's going to need those crazy animation skills. And if you're showing it off and you're doing the work, then people are going to come to you first, right?
Yes. Next question we have here from Codefinity. Have you used any of the ES6 generators in the yield keyword? It seems like they are a mechanism for async await under the hood. Thank you. So using async await is probably sufficient. I like this question because when I did my ES6, we didn't have async await. And I taught generators inside of that. And since then, I've not actually found a use case for them in my day-to-day work. So async await will compile down to generators if that works out with the browser support. But they're not the exact same thing. A kind of a cool thing about generators is that they can sort of be like long running. They don't just have to be awaiting inside of a function. So like the example that I had in my course was, I think it was like a barber shop where at the start of the day, you have an empty array and you can take your iterator and call .next on it and you get the next customer. But as people come in the shop, they get added to the end of that array. So you just keep calling next. No, it wasn't a barbershop. It was the deli counter at the, you know, at the
Mark's thing. Deli.
Yeah, Mark's Deli. You know, you get the little ticket at the deli counter and then they're like, next number is 47, right? And
come get your meat. Certain,
exactly. And if there's like nobody in line anymore, then they stop changing the number. But if there's lots of people, then you just push next after the next customer. So that was like my one example.
Very good example.
Yeah, it was. I was proud of it, but quite honestly, I've not found a good use case for using generators in the wild. And I think that async await does meet most of my use cases. Not to say that it's not a good part of JavaScript. It's just not my. I have not run it into it myself. So just tweet us if you have a good use case for generators. I'd love to see that.
Same. Cool. Next question is from Anthony. With a legacy project that has all the build dependencies, how do you decide when to retool and when to fix all of the NPM audit issues? Now, this is a question that, so it really depends on the project at hand and what the life cycle of this project is going to be and what these audit issues actually are. Me personally, if this is a project that's going to be, yes, it is a legacy project, but It doesn't have like a it's not going to go away anytime soon. I'm going to invest that time. I'm going to rip it out. I'm going to start, you know, refactoring things. I'm going to update dependencies, and I'm going to do it one at a time until it's all done. And that's just the type of person I am. But I'm also going to make sure that we have tests in place so that things don't break. I'm going to not worry about doing it all in one fell swoop, just doing a little bit at a time. Of course, there's some things that you can't do that with. Eat that frog, take care of some of the big ones, and then refactor down that way. As long as you have those tests and you have the time, I would go for it. If you don't have the time, or this project is like not going to survive for too long, then maybe that changes the discussion a little bit. So how do you decide when to retool and fix all the NPM audit issues? For me, it's like, really, what is the lifespan of this project? Am I going to be the one maintaining and working on it forever? Because if I am, then I'm going to fix it. If it's somebody else, I would probably recommend that person does all those updating, because I don't want to update a bunch of stuff I'm not going to fix, essentially.
I have somewhat of a similar approach to this type of thing. First thing I'll do is I'll look at the actual security issues that pop up and see if they're actually security issues for my application. So you run it and it says you have 300 security issues. Usually what the case is, there's like one or two or three dependencies in there that are being triggered over and over again. So take a look into like what is the actual security issue. And usually what will happen is they will show you how the security issue will arise. And then you can reference that with your code to say, am I using it in that way? Or do I have to really worry about that? And almost always it's like, if you use this thing, but you also have a regex that interpolates a variable, there's a slim chance that somebody might do something like that. And you're like, oh, okay, well, I'm not doing that at all. So that's not really an issue for me. And it'll be fine. My next thing I'll do is, sometimes I'll just try what I call a YOLO update, where I just, I run NCU, which is NPM check updates, and then -u will just update the package JSON. So I'll just go blow it away, update the entire thing and try start the app, and then run any tests that have it and see, like, can I work through any issues that are popping up in the next half an hour, an hour? And in most cases, it's just a matter of, okay, I'm running into these errors. Let me just Google those errors. Oh, here's a GitHub issue where somebody else hit that error when upgrading, and here's what to do to fix it. But if it seems like too much work, roll that sucker back and just live with the versions you have. There's nothing wrong with, if there's no security issues, then just keep running the thing that you have. I have apps that run on like Node 8 right now. And until my hosting platform will no longer run Node 8, until there's a major security issues with Node 8, then I'm not going to spend the time updating this thing just yet, because in some cases it's just not worth your time and the potential things breaking and whatnot.
Yeah. Make sure you commit back up all that stuff before running a YOLO update, just so it's easy to jump back in time and fix everything up in case it's not working. I do that too. I use Yearn Upgrade Interactive, and I won't do more than one red dependency at a time. If it's a red dependency, I'll give it a try sometimes. And
what is red? Like a full version bump?
Correct. The full version bump, a 5 to a 6. That was actually an intro. 5 to 6. Wasn't that the original name of Babel?
Yeah. Six to five.
Ooh, yeah. That makes more sense. So, yeah, no, I'll do that YOLO update as well. But again, not just doing it willy nilly. Sometimes when they do a major version update, absolutely nothing. There's no breaking changes. And if you see that in the documentation, that's the perfect use case for this thing. Go ahead and do it. Run all your tests. Make sure everything's still working. Visually confirm it yourself. And then pat yourself on the back for fixing some sort of an update there. So, yeah, I update very frequently. In fact, I know this is about legacy projects, but sometimes people ask me, you know, about keeping things up to date. And if there's like a non-breaking change in a package, I'm updating all the time. I mean, we have our tests in place for a reason, and I don't want to get too far behind. You get too far behind, everything gets a little bit more difficult. So yeah. I'm running my update stuff at least once a week, which sounds crazy, but man, every single time I run it, there's a ton of new updates. That's for sure. And I'm addicted to updates. It's like a dopamine hit for me, even though I'm not getting anything.
My main apps, I'll run it once a week, no problem, just because it's so much more manageable. You can usually read the change log of the new thing that updated. If it's just a point release, like a 1.0.1 to 1.0.2, I'll just update that because that's bug fixes. A 1.1 to like a 1.0 to a 1.1 is usually not breaking changes as well. It might be, but they're usually just adding features and fixing bugs. And then a full version bump. And that's when you got to really read the change log. But like some good, like especially Mongoose does this, is they'll wait like 2 years. If they remove a method, they'll wait like 2 years and just throw warnings in your console for 2 years, but while you fix it and then finally deprecate it, which is really cool of them.
Right. Give you that time before. And they'll alert you in the console, like React does that, says, hey, don't use this unsafe method or whatever. Those things are definitely helpful. Does the NPM version, whatever the NPU, is that what it is? Or NCU. Does NCU not color code? Because one of the things I love is it does or does not?
It does color code.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah. Because that's what I really like about the Yarn Upgrade Interactive is that like red for major version, yellow for minor version, green for patch. I mean, really easy to see at a glance what's good and what's not.
Yeah, that's key. Next question we have here is from Muhammad Tala. In what instances do you prefer to use REM versus M versus pixels for size? I usually like to think of it as, so if I'm okay with an element's font size being based on the parent, then I'll use M. If not, I'll use a REM. I'll almost never use pixels anymore, except for on the HTML element. I'm assuming that's to set the base font size. But even then, I usually use a percentage. If you set the HTML element, this is me jumping in. If you set HTML into what, to 62.5%, that gives it a base of 10. In practice, me neither. I just set 10px. In practice, I found it a bit hard to gauge what to expect M's of because of nesting issues. So I've been leaning towards using REM, though I thought understanding the REMs can be less modular. Can you guys make some decision on this? So we've talked about this a lot on the podcast, but we can do it again. So sizing things, what I usually do is I'll set a base font size on my HTML element, usually just to 10px. And then I set most of my other stuff to be REMs, and that's going to be based off of 10. And that way, if you ever need to scale up the entire website or down the entire website, then you can simply just change the base font size off of that. So at the end of the day, I'm still calculating in my head how many pixels things should be, because at the end of the day, our screens still are in pixels, right? For M's, I very rarely use M's, but their use case is for exactly what you said. When you want to size something based on its parent font size, then you use an M. So in my latest course, we did the logo entirely in CSS, and everything, the border size, the padding, the font size, the amount of tilt on each of the things, all of those things were based on how big it was. And if I want to scale up or down the logo accordingly, all you have to do is change the font size of the logo root, and then everything else will scale exactly the same amount up and down, which is cool. And you could do that with calc as well, but it's pretty easy to do with M's. And same with my, if you go to westboss.com and go to one of my blog posts, there's like a little yellow square in the top right-hand corner of all of my H1 through H6 elements. Those are M's because I said, make this like 2M by 2M. And then regardless of how big the font size is, it's always scaled up proportionally.
Yeah. For me with font sizes, I think things that made me a better CSS developer when I was learning CSS. Font sizes, I just about never declare a font size on a container ever. I'm trying to think of a situation where I would do that. And that's made working with M's way easier. Now, granted, if you're not declaring a font size on the container and they're just relative to the body, you might as well use REM anyways. So there's not really too much of a benefit there, but maybe it leaves the opportunity open. I think the key distinction is that you know when and why. But like, you know what I'm not doing is I'm not saying, you know, my header font size is 16 pixels when I really mean the nav is, you know, if I have a nav item, that styling is going to be attached to essentially that element itself, whether that is the list item or whatever. And then that way you don't have to worry about those weird issues that you encounter when you're first learning EMS or REMS, where this thing is not the correct size that you're expecting it to, all because of the root is not what you're expecting it to be, whatever it's relative to. So I don't define any font sizes on containers. I basically set up my entire typography system as font sizes on elements. And then I also set all of those font sizes as custom properties. So I have like an H4 custom or CSS variable. Sorry. I think they're actually like legit called CSS variables now and not custom properties anymore. Either way. Because I've been calling them custom properties to try to stay like legit. And then I think they're in, can I use as CSS variables now? Either way, I set up like an, you know, I'll have an H2 as that's my CSS variable, just in case I need to reset an H3 to be the size of an H2 or somewhere in the code, right? But again, I'm only ever updating the font size on the thing itself and not the container to avoid any sort of weird root issues. But in your use case, that is where you have like the squares being relative to the parent. That is such a good use case. But unfortunately, that type of thing, it like doesn't pop up that much. So me personally, I use EMS, but for no good reason, really. I functionally use them the same as REMS and most likely use them interchangeably just because of my practices in CSS.
Speaking of fonts, which have stacks, font stacks.
I think that was a good transition.
Yeah. Speaking of fonts, which have font stacks, another type of stack that we should take about is one of our sponsors, which is Stackbit. So Stackbit offers developer tools that enable things like inline content editing, live previewing of content changes, and collaboration features on your Jamstack website. So if you've got a Jamstack website already, so whether that's a Gatsby website or Next.js or Nuxt, and you've already hooked it up with whatever CMS you're using on the back end, they support all kinds of different CMSs like Sanity, Contentful, Dado CMS, Netlify CMS, Forestry. So you still use both of those things, but you as the developer can take Jamstack to allow you to do things like real-time editing, real-time previews, all the kinds of tools. It's really cool. It gives you that extra, like I think like if you're building a website, a lot of the marketers are really going to appreciate this feature set added on to your Jamstack website because it fixes a lot of the little downsides that we have with the Jamstack. So check it out at stackbit.com. It's the best way to Jamstack. Thanks so much to Stackbit for sponsoring. Let's grab one more question here and we will pick it up from there. Actually, this is a perfect question from talking about Jamstack and things like that, headless CMS. This is, hello, chaps. Hey, Billy. Thanks so much for the show. I learned an awful lot listening through. I've been dabbling in development for some time now, and I've taken on a project for an Express site, which aside from a few static pages, will include a shop with a number of small items, a customer dashboard for order tracking, submitting supplementary info, and an image-centric journal blog section. I've listened and re-listened to your CMS roundup, which is great, but having worked through Wes's Node course, I'm kind of thinking, why would I spend time integrating a CMS when I can just build an add post page for admin users, save the post in MongoDB, upload the images to my server, and use Cloudflare's free CDN tier? Please explain to me why this or this isn't a bad idea, or more generally, share your wisdom on when a CMS is actually necessary. Peace. I think this is a really interesting question because like that's the answer. It's like, why would I use a external package or a service when I can just build that myself? Like Wes's course showed me how we can make an admin area. We can edit the thing. We can create a form. We can update it and you're up and running. So like, first of all, good on you for doing that, because I think in a world of slap all these services together and all of a sudden your website costs $400 a month, being able to just do it all yourself is key. But why would you want to use a CMS over just building it all yourself? Because reinventing the wheel, quite honestly, there's a lot of finesse that like last 10% of building a UI, hitting all the different edge cases of being able to do something, like your client's going to come in and say, all right, I have these two lists of content. How do I reorder them? And then also I have one in the wrong list. I want to drag it out of that list into the other list. How do I do that? And you go like, oh, well, you can't. Like, I didn't build this like amazing drag and drop UI where you can cross data paths and relate content and things like that. I just gave you a text box where you can type it in. And that's where CMSs really tend to shine, because that like example I just gave, like that might take a developer 2 weeks to build that thing, when it's just like a small percentage of the little UI that you get for free in a CMS. Plus things like an API, data validation, maybe a GraphQL API comes already with it. There's a lot to gain in terms of speed and not having to reinvent the wheel when you reach for a CMS. But then there's also a lot of control that you can have when you do go ahead and build the whole thing yourself.
Yeah, I think I experienced this firsthand myself just about all the time. Because I, you know, coded my own backend entirely for Level Up Tutorials, and we had to do just about every single basic CMS feature that you can imagine in my platform, right? Anytime I need it, I got to build it, drag and drop to reorder, whatever, I got to build it. And it's both a strength and a weakness, because at the same time, some of the things I'm most proud of in the Level Up Tutorials code base are some of the admin tools, as in my like tutorial builder, the course builder, the series importer. All those things are really cool that I've made, and I've really spent the time to make them cool. But imagine how many hours I spent building that stuff that I could have been spending doing other things, you know, adding more functionality, recording more, just all sorts of things. And now, granted, I really like building admin tools. It's a lot of fun. That like basic CMS sort of stuff is fun for me to work on. But at the end of the day, sometimes it is just like hedging, like how much do you need to do yourself versus what is the actual cost of making these decisions in time, right? I don't know. It's a tough, because at the time when I made Level Up Tutorials, there probably wasn't any good option to do all this stuff. Now there's like things like Reaction Commerce or Ghost or some of these other platforms that could have done all this stuff for me in ways that are probably a little bit better because there's more manpower working on it. So there's definitely trade-offs to think about there. And custom tools are really sweet, but they are definitely a big, heavy chunk of your time. That's for sure.
All right. Great question. Thanks so much for asking that. Let's move into some sick picks.
So this sick pick is kind of interesting. Have you heard of foam, Wes?
I've heard of foam.
Foam.
What's foam?
Foambubble.github.io/foam. That's not the best URL. This is totally unrelated. I was listening to a podcast just for fun to hear what kind of other tech podcasts are out there, you know, just to give a listen. And this person's like, I'll have it in the show notes. They didn't. So it wasn't in the show notes for a link for this thing I really wanted to check up on. And then they were like, or you can just visit blank.blank/blank/blank/blank. And I was just like, oh my God, it was like the longest URL. It was like not even related to anything. I was just like, come on, I'm not going to type this in correctly. Okay. So foam. So foam is really interesting. Foam is a personal management sharing solution inspired by Rome research, built on Visual Studio Code and GitHub. Now, if any of those words sounded familiar to you, you might give yourself a pat on the back. Some of this stuff is really cool. I don't use Rome myself. I use something called Obsidian. Obsidian is an application for taking connected notes where you can easily link between things. And I found it to be a better fit for my notes than something like Notion. I use Notion for databases and tracking and all sorts of stuff, but I don't use it for my notes because Obsidian is really nice with this whole, there's a method. It starts with a Z. It's a long word. I'm sorry. I'm blanking on this method's name. Oh, the Zettelkasten. Oh my gosh. Zettelkasten. That is not a word that I'm going to be able to say correctly without hearing somebody else say it, but it's all building a second brain thing where you can do this sort of really neat little linking syntax and have all of your documents be linked in this giant graph of connected information. And it's fantastic. So I've been using Obsidian to do this because it writes to Markdown files. And then these cool people created Foam, which is basically a Visual Studio Code version of this exact same thing, where you can work in Markdown apps. You get the graph view. You can link between things. It's all Markdown. It's all connected. So instead of having to have some third-party app that is like essentially mimicking Visual Studio Code, well, you just got it all in Visual Studio Code, and it's really cool. It's very, very cool. So check it out here. It's still early days, so a lot of the install stuff is a little rough, I found. There was like some interesting things where it's like, oh, to get started, just clone this GitHub template. And then you clone the template. And the problem is the template has like a bunch of like custom VS Code extensions and configuration. But for some reason, it's like they felt the need to define a theme and define a font and stuff like that. It's like, I don't want you to change my font or theme. I want you to use my theme and font. So just little things like that. But it's still early days. It's very cool. If you're looking for a free note-taking open source application that uses sort of like the Rome research ideas, then you're going to want to check out Foam. It's very cool. I'm very into it.
Beauty. I'm going to sick pick a YouTube video called How to Use a Multimeter for Beginners. So I've had a multimeter forever, and I know how to use AC and DC and check for continuity. But I was just sitting there the other day and being like, I don't know what all these other things on this multimeter are for. I don't know why there's different numbers on AC and DC. I don't know what resistance is. So I sat down and I was like, I learned it all. And it's just like a 10-minute video. And I'm just sitting at my desk with a couple electronics parts. You can sort of follow along yourself. And I learned a lot from it. I think it is a modern skill that everybody should have. So check out this. I'll link it up in the show notes. How to use a multimeter.
Cool. Well, awesome. Very thick. I'm gonna check that one out. Shameless plugs. I have a new course on CSS design system using CSS variables. It's very cool. The whole focus of the course is to accomplish as much as possible with writing as little actual CSS as possible and making things available through sort of configuration design variables. Some people call these design tokens, and they're not necessarily design tokens, but it's following that same kind of idea. And so this whole course is, again, about writing minimalist CSS to accomplish some very cool things, including creating a theming system. So not just a dark mode, a light mode, but, you know, a Wave Race 64 theme if you want it. So check it out, leveluptutorials.com/pro.
Beautiful. I'm going to shamelessly plug all of my courses, westboss.com/courses. Use coupon code syntax for $10 off. Learn you a thing or two, JavaScript, CSS, you name it. Enjoy.
Cool.
All right. That's it. Thank you so much for tuning in, and we will catch you on Monday. Peace.
Peace. Head on over to syntax.fm for a full archive of all of our shows. And don't forget to subscribe in your podcast player or drop a review if you like this show.